Faye, it feels really nice to be back and recording podcasts again after parental leave, but even 6 weeks later, I feel like I have missed a whole world of things in OBGYN.
Yeah, me too, especially 9 weeks out. But thankfully for us, we can refresh our memory with the OBG project.
That's right. The OBG project kind of has their great summaries and these bullet point formats online. They've got resident exclusive resources, the core curriculum, and they've got a new project in the primary care med project. You can check that out as well, which lets you get up to date with all those primary care guidelines that we got to keep up with too.
And even better, if you're a resident, remember that you can get OBG first absolutely free. So if you want to figure out how to do that, go ahead and go onto our website, click on the sidebar, and link to the OBG project. All right, guys, welcome back. This is Faye.
This is Nick.
And this is
Creogs
over coffee. All right, guys. So today we are going to talk about a topic that actually I realized that Nick and I probably haven't done for 3 years now, but it's something that we should talk about because it's part of the Creog learning objectives, and that is circumcision, what to know as an OBGYN. So what are our learning objectives today, Nick?
Yeah, so we're gonna just again discuss circumcisions as an OBGYN. We'll talk through some of the risks and benefits to discuss with patients about circumcision if they're asking you about that in the office or if you do circumcisions at the time of procedure. And then finally, we'll review the steps of the circumcision with probably the most common device that is used that's known as the GOMCO clamp. So Faye, let's start off. That you said it. The CREOG learning objectives say we need to learn about them. So why do we need to learn about circumcisions as an OBGYN?
You know, this never made sense to me because I always said, you know what, I don't really deal with babies once they come out, and I certainly don't deal with, patients who are assigned male at birth most of the time. But here we are. And this is because some hospitals and locations require OBGYNs to do circumcision. So it is something that we may need to know as a skill. And Nick and I certainly did. We did them in our East Coast large academic hospital that we went to. And it seems that in the Midwest, the majority are also done by the OBGYNs. And this is sometimes because of, lack of availability of pediatric urologists. There are not as many of them around as OBGYNs. Circumcision is sometimes seen as a surgical procedure, and therefore they should be done by surgeons per the hospital or whoever's overseeing them. And that can be us, who are the most available, who are the OBGYNs. But it's important to know that circumcisions can be done by pediatricians as well as family medicine physicians and, of course, the pediatric urologist. So there are many, many other people who are able to provide this service. And like I said, we are talking about it today because it is a learning objective for CREOG. All right. So talk to us now about some background, Nick. Talk to us a little bit about, how circumcisions are in the U.S.
Yeah. So no, I think many folks are familiar with the idea that circumcision is frequently done for religious or cultural reasons. In the U.S., we might call it a cultural thing, too. It's kind of an interesting fact that the U.S. is the only country in the quote-unquote developed world where the majority of male infants are circumcised for a non-religious reason. And the overall prevalence of circumcision is approximately 80% for males that are aged 14 to 59. This prevalence is highest overall in the Midwest, followed by the Northeast and the South, and the prevalence of circumcision is lowest overall in the Western states of the United States. So again, some kind of interesting interstate culture that's evolved here around this. And again, depending on where you practice, you may encounter this either as a practice or may encounter this as a question more frequently than others. So let's say, Faye, we do get a patient who comes in, whether again prenatal care or after delivery, and they're inquiring about circumcision. How do we need to counsel the patient about circumcision for the neonate?
Yeah. So first of all, you need to make sure that the caregiver or the parent make sure that they're given factually correct information about the circumcision itself. So first, you should tell them that it is an elective procedure. The discussion should definitely include things like social, cultural, and religious aspects of the procedure, and also the parents' or caregivers' personal preferences. It's interesting to note that in a survey, 40 to 67% of parents reported that they desired circumcision because of hygiene and medical benefits, whereas 23 to 37% had the procedure for some social reasons, and only 11 to 19% of them for religious reasons in the United States. And finally, it's just important to let them know that should the parents wait until the child is old enough to determine if they want a circumcision, that the procedure in adults has greater risks, greater costs, more procedure and post-procedural comfort, discomfort, and longer recovery period overall than when it's done in the newborn period. Next, of course, we should talk about the potential benefits. So tell me what those are, Nick.
Yeah, so circumcision has been purportedly associated with some medical benefits. There are lower rates of UTIs, lower rates of penile cancer, lower rates of penile inflammation, dermatoses, sexually transmitted infection. And a lower rate of UTI is certainly a major benefit in infancy. We can think about sort of, you know, the baby that's coming in for no infection, NOS, very sick, and getting the kind of up and down workup. And UTI is a major contributor to that. But kind of to counterbalance, it's important to note that UTI is pretty uncommon in males of any age. And there are comparative studies that show that circumcised male infants have significantly fewer UTIs than uncircumcised male infants, but there are no RCTs of this. There's one systematic review out there of 12 studies with 400,000 male infants that showed a 90% decreased risk. But when we think about that in terms of a kind of absolute risk reduction, we're talking about 7 to 14 per thousand uncircumcised male infants will develop a UTI during the first year of life, compared with 1 to 2 per thousand of circumcised male infants. So again, we're talking about from about 10 per thousand to 1 to 2 per thousand in terms of that risk reduction. The long-term sequelae from UTI are unlikely as long as the urinary tract is normal and the UTI, of course, is treated. So again, kind of you take that for what you will in terms of the benefit. What about other benefits, Faye, that are kind of lower in incidence, if you will?
Yeah, so the other things that we talked about are lower risk of penile cancer, reduction in penile inflammation, and reduction in HIV and other STIs. To kind of go through these very quickly, penile cancer itself overall is very, very rare. And in the U.S., the age-adjusted incidence is about 1 in 100,000 males. And systematic review and meta-analyses show a strong protective factor of childhood and adolescent circumcision on invasive penile cancer with an odds ratio of 0.33. But in two studies, the protective effect did not persist when analyses were restricted to boys with no history of phimosis. So it does seem that potentially that risk is increased if there's phimosis, but not necessarily decreased just with circumcision itself. And then the other thing to remember is that the number needed to treat to prevent one case of penile cancer is to do is a wide range, but it's somewhere between 909 to 322,000 circumcisions. So certainly the number needed to treat is very, very large. In terms of reduction in penile inflammation and retractile disorders, in a case series, these issues are described in higher incidences in uncircumcised males, which makes sense because, you know, it's impossible to have phimosis or retractile disorders if there is no foreskin there. And the rate of penile inflammation and phimosis were higher in uncircumcised boys, which is about 14.4 versus 7.6 out of 100, and 3.7 versus 0 out of 100. And finally, in terms of reduction of in HIV and other sexually transmitted infections, there is high-quality evidence that circumcision does protect against HIV, HPV, and probably HSV-2. However, it's important to know that it is not as good as using just your plain old barrier method, so using condoms. All right, so those are kind of the protective or the benefits of getting a circumcision in terms of medical sense. What about the risks, Nick?
Yeah, so there are certainly risks, as we always talk about with any surgery or procedure, of complications, right? But for circumcision, accurate complication rates are difficult to determine overall for a variety of reasons, but I think most frequently because some of the early things are kind of cosmetic related and they may be not well coded or difficult to actually ascertain. In two studies that included over 200,000 circumcisions in the U.S., the rate of complication described in the first month after the procedure was just 0.2%. And some of these listed complications include, again, cosmesis, things like inadequate skin removal or just an unsatisfactory appearance, bleeding risks, infection risks, complications with respect to the urethra or an injury to the glands. There's also kind of the other risks of removing excessive skin, having adhesive things form, skin bridges form, and then finally, very rare but possible anesthetic complications as well. So again, kind of just into your full counseling, you certainly want to talk about some of those upfront procedural risks that we always talk about, bleeding, infection, anesthesia complications, but then also some of these things that may not manifest until later on. There's also the concern for sexual dissatisfaction. Some folks express concern that the end of the penis may become less sensitive and sexual sensation may decrease with foreskin removed. But most circumcised males don't describe any psychological trauma or decreased sexual function, sensation, or desire. And so these kind of concerns have yet to be totally substantiated in the literature. Okay, so Faye, when we've got this where the benefit may be small-ish overall, we could probably say is fair to say, and then there are risks that are there but are also fairly small or may not be completely substantiated in the literature, I guess we have to look towards our specialty societies or those who really study this and look at it with experts' opinions to say, what should we do? So what do they say we should do?
Yeah. So interestingly, the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2012, a task force on circumcision of the male infant, concluded that the health benefits of newborn male circumcision actually outweighs the risks. But they did not outright come out and say that they recommended circumcision. And interestingly, this statement from the task force was not renewed. ACOG at the time also endorsed the conclusions of the AAP, but like I said, this specific task force statement was not renewed afterwards. In 2012, the American Urologic Association also believed that neonatal circumcision has potential medical benefits and advantages, however, also said that there were disadvantages and risks, but again, did not come out to make any form of formal recommendation to do circumcisions or not. And then finally, the WHO actually considered male circumcision to be part of a comprehensive HIV prevention package in Africa and other places with high HIV prevalence and low rates of male circumcision. So certainly, potentially, if that we were in other countries where there are high risks of HIV and low circumcision rates, then potentially this would be recommended. But the United States really is not one of those places. All right. So now that we've kind of talked through all the risks and benefits and we've counseled our patient, let's say they still want their child to get that circumcision. So how would you perform the circumcision?
Yeah. So there's lots of ways. And depending on where you are, you may be listening to this and say, hey, you guys mentioned a GOMCO. That's not what I do. In this podcast, we're going to describe a GOMCO because it is overall pretty common, and it's also the way Faye and I trained predominantly. So sorry to all of you out there who are Plastibel fans or Mogen fans or any of the other techniques. This is just how we've done it, and so we'll just share that with you all. But certainly, as you all discuss the podcast or kind of want to share your experience, we're welcome to hearing about it. So we'll put a picture of the GOMCO clamp on our website, but there are a couple of parts. So there is this metal plate that has a hole at one end, and then there's also this round metal cap that's known as the bell. And kind of the bell is used to protect the glands, and the hole is basically used as a kind of a stabilizing area for the penis to be placed for the procedure. There's also a screw device that helps to crush the foreskin ultimately, but we'll get into the steps momentarily. So you just have three pieces, that metal plate with a hole at the end, the round metal cap called the bell, and then the screw device as your parts of the GOMCO. Other instruments and things that you should have for preparation for the procedure, you need to have needle and syringe for lidocaine injection. Remember that if you're using lidocaine, the dose that you should be using, if you're using lidocaine without epinephrine, is 4.5 milligrams per kilogram. this matters a lot. Again, we mentioned earlier anesthesia complications. You're doing these on a 3 to 4 kilo baby, right? And so you can't just go crazy with the administration of your lidocaine. You got to really pay attention to the dosing and how much you're administering, not to exceed, you know, you're shooting for 4.5 milligrams per kilogram. You'll need 3 straight hemostats, ideally, in order to perform the procedure. And then you'll also need a scalpel and a set of scissors. Faye, you want to take us through the steps of the procedure?
Sure. I hope I remember. So first, just like any procedure that you do, you're going to want to prep and drape the area. Usually we will have a board where the infant is unfortunately kind of strapped down so that they can't move, and we prep the area with some betadine to make sure that it's sterile. Most infants can also be given some sugar water and a pacifier for comfort in alongside of the lidocaine. So next, we're going to anesthetize the infant with lidocaine 1%. We do this via a dorsal penile nerve block, and this is done by injecting at the 2 dorsolateral sites, which is the 2 and 10 o'clock position at the base of the penis. And you should, ideally, we'll do this 3 to 8 minutes prior to incision so that the lidocaine has a chance to work. You're then going to grasp the foreskin at the 2 and 10 o'clock position right at the opening near the glands with the 2 straight hemostats, and you're going to place the 3rd hemostat between them at the 12 o'clock position within the opening of the foreskin and run it around the glands to separate it from the glands itself. Once this is done, you then place that 3rd hemostat at the 12 o'clock position again, close the clamp, and crush the portion of the foreskin there, and cut this crushed area afterwards with the scissors. This is going to allow you to open the prepuce or the foreskin and pull it away from the glands itself. You're going to then check the glands for any other adhesions, which you can then take down with some type of sponge or, you know, with a cloth that you have alongside. Then you're going to apply the bell of the GOMCO over the glands. You're going to pull the foreskin over the bell itself so that basically the foreskin comes around the bell and the glands itself is within the bell. The foreskin should not be too snug over the bell itself, and the skin below the bell should also be relaxed and supple. And it may be helpful to use the straight hemostat to hold together the cut foreskin above the bell. You're then going to apply the metal clamp of the metal plate of the clamp at the level of the corona, tighten down the clamp, make sure that everything is in proper alignment, and this is going to cut off the blood flow to the area that will be cut. And this is usually where you will use that screw to really tighten that area. Finally, you then take your scalpel, you make a circumferential cut around the base of the bell, right at the level of the plate. And then once you're done, you remove the clamp after a few minutes to allow for clotting and coagulation. And for the next few diaper changes, you're going to place some KY jelly or some antibiotic ointment, depending on what you do at your hospital, in cotton balls in the diaper to avoid having that cut area stick to the diaper itself. And that is pretty much a procedure. And I remember, you know, when we were doing it, that it would take probably, oh, I don't know, like 5 minutes a baby. And we could do a bunch of them all at the same time. All right, Nick, I think that brings us to the end of this episode. So let's go ahead and summarize.
Yeah, so we started off talking about just, you know, why do we need to learn this? We mentioned it is a CREOG learning objective, so you could see this on your CREOGs. But some hospitals and locations require OBGYNs to do circumcisions. Again, we did our residency out on the East Coast and did them as residents, and it seems like in the Midwest, the majority are also done by OBGYNs. There's a variety of reasons OBGYNs do them, because there may be a lack of availability for pediatric urologists, or that circumcision is seen as a surgical procedure that's more in our domain. But you also may run into pediatricians, family medicine physicians, who are also very comfortable with doing circumcisions.
In terms of counseling your patients, make sure that you're giving your patients factually correct information. Tell them that this is an elective procedure. Make sure that you are taking into consideration all the social, cultural, and religious aspects of the procedure itself. And also letting them know that, you know, you can do the procedure when they're a newborn, but if they wait until later on, it's actually potentially a more risky and more painful procedure later on.
In terms of potential benefits of circumcision, one of the purported benefits is a lower rate of urinary tract infection, though it is important to note that UTI is pretty uncommon in males of any age. This risk in terms of a relative risk reduction may be decreased as significantly as 90%, but we're talking about 7 to 14 UTIs per 1,000 uncircumcised infants within the first year of life, compared to 1 to 2 UTIs per 1,000 circumcised male infants in the first year of life. Long-term sequelae from UTI are also fairly unlikely. There's also reduced risk of things like penile cancer, though again, the incidence of this is very rare, and as Faye describes, the number needed to treat ranges from close to 1,000 to over 300,000. There's also potential rates of reduction in penile inflammation, retractile disorders, and then there also is high-quality evidence that circumcision does protect against HIV, HPV, and probably HSV2, though it's not as good as barrier methods in terms of this reduction.
Risks in general are very rare for circumcisions, but in two studies that showed that included over 200,000 circumcisions, the rate of complication after the first month was about 0.2%. Most of these included things like cosmetic dissatisfaction, bleeding, infection, urethral complications, very rarely things like gland injury or other things like adhesions and anesthetic complications. There's also some concern about possible sexual dissatisfaction, but again, most circumcised males don't describe psychological trauma or decreased sexual function in any way. The difference societies, interestingly, do say that some of the medical benefits outweigh the risks, but none of them outright come and say in the United States that they recommend circumcision, though the WHO does consider male circumcision to be part of a comprehensive HIV prevention package in places where there is high HIV prevalence and low rates of male circumcision.
Finally, we talked through the performance of a circumcision procedurally using the GOMCO clamp. We'll have a photo of the GOMCO clamp on our website, a sort of schematic of the procedural steps as well as listing those procedural steps, but we won't bore you through a secondary version of that now. You may also encounter things like Plastibel or Mogen as alternative ways to do circumcision in your practice. All right, Faye, well, I think that brings us to the end of this podcast on circumcision. Once again, this is Nick.
This is Faye.
And this has been Creogs Over Coffee. So guys, if you enjoyed the podcast, head over to iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, whatever your podcatcher is, give us a 5-star rating and review.
You can find us on social media on X at Creogs Over Coffee1, on Facebook and Instagram at Creogs Over Coffee. And if you want to donate to the show, go ahead and go over to our Patreon at www.patreon.com/Creogs Over Coffee.
You can find show notes for this episode and all of our previous episodes on our website, creogsovercoffee.com.
And if you want to reach out to us, have a question about the show, have ideas for an episode or a correction for us, go ahead and email us, creogsovercoffee@gmail.com.